I will call this meeting of the Civil Law and Elections Committee to order. We do not have our minutes yet from the last meeting, but we will. It appears probably need to meet one more time anyway, because there's at least one bill that did not make the deadline. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, my bill 2118 was laid on the table for possible inclusion, and I'd like to call that off the table and move that we move it to the General Register.
All right, we will take, I will take 2118 off the table.
Do you need the button?
Yes.
I can just take it off. So I have done that. The bill is before us again. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, this is a elections bill that the Secretary of State's office brought before us, and it really just provides an opportunity for copies on all elections, and it's not any extra work, and that's why there's no fiscal note on this at all, and it is fairly simple and straightforward, and I think we need to move it to the General Register so it doesn't bog down.
All right, Representative Nelson, is this your A1 amendment?
Actually, I was going to offer it.
All right.
Offer the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Representative Emmer.
The A1 amendment is simply a reworking of two bills that have already passed this committee. One is the Omnibus Elections Bill, which you can find from pages 1 through 1 through 68, and then on 68, I believe, starting with Article 6, is 2116, which was the Disclosure and Transparency Bill that I offered.
All right.
So these are two bills, and I'm offering them as an amendment to Representative Nelson's 2118.
All right. So, Representative Emmer, the omnibus bill was the one we just passed a few days ago or late last week.
Yes.
Discussion to this amendment, and just to explain that to anyone who doesn't know, it appears that the Senate may not be doing an omnibus bill. We based our omnibus bill on what they asked us to put in, and for some reason they decided not to. So I think Representative Emmer thought it would be smart to get his two bills on at least one bill that they have an interest in. Representative Simon.
It's just a procedural question. I'm not sure who this should go to, Mr. Chair, whether you or Representative Emmer. Is this then, Representative Emmer, Article 6, starting on page 68, is this exactly the bill as we pass it out of here without recommendation?
No, it's... Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Representative Simon, there were some amendments made in public safety. The big amendment in public safety included raising the limits on the statewide offices. And you'll note, if you look in the amended engrossment that's included in Article 6, that includes the governor is $2.5 million, I believe. The attorney general, I think, is somewhere around $1.2 million. And then the state auditor and the secretary of state are another third less than that, I think it was. But other than that, it's the bill that we passed. And one other exception, Representative Simon, the caps have been taken out. Remember the significant caps at the end of the bill on contributions?
Mr. Simon,
are you referring to the caps, the sort of the mini McCain-Feingold?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, yes. That was the amendment made in public safety.
Representative Emmer, we're not taking out any caps that are in law, but just some new ones that you had proposed, correct?
Right. Mr. Chairman, in the original 2116, this committee may recall there were some significant proposed limitations on the contribution structure, and those were removed in public safety at the same time that we added the increased limits on the statewide campaigns. Those were the changes.
Okay. Further discussion to the A1 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any further discussion on 2118 as amended? Seeing no discussion, Representative Nelson will renew his motion, or actually, I don't know if he made one or not, but will renew his motion that House File 2118 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I believe the next bill on the agenda is Representative Lanning, who is just outside in his office here, so that would be 2226. Welcome, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, I move House File 2226 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I appreciate the opportunity to come back before you and continue our consideration of this legislation. Mr. Chairman, I just...
Representative Lanning, I'm sorry, I wasn't here the day that we heard this, and I understand we defeated it, so I think we need a motion to reconsider. Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll move to reconsider House File 2226.
Representative De La Forest moves to reconsider 2226. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, the bill is now before us, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Point of clarification. One of the things that the committee did adopt was the A4 amendment, which is a technical amendment, and I guess my question would be, does that action still stand, or do you need to again take action on the A4 amendment?
Why don't we do it again just to be safe, Representative Lanning?
Okay.
If you could tell us what that is, or if we have it.
Well, it's basically a technical amendment. I guess I could refer to Ms. McKnight to explain this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning and members, I'm not sure that the A4 amendment is in your package, but this is the amendment that coordinates the election law and the guardianship law and makes reference in primarily in the election law, there may be one amendment in the guardianship law, to the effect of guardianship on voting. As you may remember from a couple of years ago, those of you who were serving at the time, since the guardianship law changed so that people don't lose their right to vote unless the court makes a specific finding that they've lost the right to vote. If the court makes that finding, then things will happen to your voter registration, and this amendment that we're discussing just reflects those changes throughout the law. We had picked some of those changes up in 03 and 04, and there's still some more to be done this year. It's essentially how the agency.
And members, I wasn't here, but you adopted this amendment last time. Usually we would have this in front of us, but unless there's an objection, since that was already done, I will move that A4 amendment that was adopted when Representative Lanning was last before us. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is readopted.
Mr. Chairman, we discussed at the last meeting the A2 amendment, and we have had continuing discussions with the Secretary of State's office, and we have made some additional changes to that A2 amendment, and now you have before you the A5 amendment, which incorporates changes that the Secretary of State's office was particularly interested in making.
I will move the H2226A5 amendment. Representative Lanning, did you want to explain these, or did you want to just open up the questions?
Well, if you would like, Mr. Chairman, I explained the bill overall when I was before the committee before. I don't need to do that again unless you would like me to. I would be happy to go through and explain the amendment if you would like me to do that.
Maybe if you could just explain any substantive or significant changes in it, that would be great.
Okay. Then to the A5 amendment. This contains a number of changes. It, first of all, clarifies that photo IDs that show the name and residential address of the voter must be government issued. Makes it clear that these should be government issued photo IDs and not something that someone could simply manufacture or fraudulently develop. It also adds the signed residential lease to the list of items that can be used to establish residency. And it requires that a photo ID be used in combination with residential leases, utility bills, bank statements, government checks, paychecks, and other government documents. I feel that it's very important that in accepting these other things to verify address, that we also establish that the person whose address is on that statement is actually the person presenting himself or herself as a voter. And I feel by requiring a photo ID strengthens this, and I think further limits the possibility of fraud creeping into the system. And it also requires a photo ID for students with their student fee statements. And we go on to clarify that an employee at a residential facility can only vouch for residents of that facility. That was a concern that was expressed to us. We clarified that. Let's see, it provides for definitions for bank statements, government checks, paychecks, and other government documents and utilities bills to make sure that election judges clearly understand what those statements mean. It changes the language on voter registration cards to clarify what it means for an ex-felon to have had their civil rights restored in a way that more closely mirrors the statute. We, over the objection of the Secretary of State's office, we eliminated or deleted that requirement that voter registration cards be printed in black. We took that out and to follow what the Secretary of State's office wishes us to have. The amendment limits the option of removing one's name from the public information list to those who sign a statement that they want to be removed from the list because they fear for their safety. This is the same standard that's used by the Department of Motor Vehicles, and so it's consistent with other state policy. Section 6 has been deleted, which was a section objected to by the Secretary of State's office. We add a subdivision which requires the county auditor to mail absentee ballots to the study abroad offices of college and universities within their county. And we delete the requirement that the Secretary of State adopt rules for the trainings and requirement for a procedure for emergency training. Instead, the amendment adopts language from the rules related to election judge trainings regarding training certificates, the timing of the trainings, and the content that the trainings must cover. And finally, Mr. Chairman, the amendment changes the language on the Voters' Bill of Rights to clarify what it means for an ex-felon to have had their civil rights restored in a way that more closely mirrors the statute. So those are the changes that are incorporated into the A5 amendment. Be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. Any discussion or questions on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, did Ms. Frazier wish to testify? Or are you just here for questions?
Just here for questions.
All right. I see no discussion on the A5 amendment. Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, I got a question for Ms. Frazier. Does your organization feel that this amendment is in the kind of shape you think it should be in?
Ms. Frazier, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Frazier. I'm the Public Policy Director with MAPA, the Minnesota Alliance for Progressive Action. Yes, Representative Ellison and Mr. Chair, we like this amendment. We think it will make it easier for people to register to vote. There are more ways to establish your residency. It also allows for employees at residential facilities to vouch for people that live there. We've talked about that in relation to other bills and how that can be problematic, particularly for women in battered women's shelters and the homeless who don't know people in the neighborhood necessarily. It conforms with the Help America Vote Act and broadens and allows documents that can be used under that federal act to be used in Minnesota for same-day registration. It will help students in that it requires counties to mail absentee ballot applications to study abroad offices. It also will be particularly helpful for students in that it allows you to use a lease to establish your residency along with a photo ID, but doesn't say that the photo ID has to be a Minnesota driver's license. So, for example, if you're from Wisconsin but living here, you can show your lease to establish your residency and your photo ID from Wisconsin to establish that that's who you are. And it provides for trainings for challengers so that they know exactly what the requirements are to be eligible. And it, based on concerns from the Secretary of State's office, no longer requires the Secretary of State's office to adopt rules regarding those trainings. Instead, we have outlined what the training should cover and when they should be held in this amendment.
Mr. Nelson?
No further, thank you.
All right, any further discussion on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A5 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Emmer?
Yes.
I had you on my list. Did you have an oral amendment that you wanted to make?
I do, but I think perhaps Tony Kokoski from the Secretary of State's office is here to explain the amendment in detail and answer any questions, and then I'd like to move the amendment.
That's great. Mr. Kokoski, if you want to come forward. Thank you, Ms. Frazier.
Members of the committee, Tony Kalkowski, Deputy Secretary of State. On the amendment that you just adopted, there were some concerns in that amendment from our office. And I do have some suggestions. If you go back to the amendment, page one, and looking at the issue there on IDs, our suggestion would be to take a look at lines dropping, lines 14 through 16, and then adding the following language, starting at after the first then when you do this, is a public housing lease, a rent statement or agreement, a rent statement or agreement provided by a subsidized housing program, property tax statement, bill for gas, electricity, telephone, wireless telephone, cable television, solid waste, water or services, and a current and valid photo ID.
No,
the question is that dealing with all government-issued photo IDs, I think there's a number of issues there, because it's mentioned over on a couple of other pages. And I guess I need to ask a clarification of the author, too, is because when I looked at the other photo identification list that was there, it was much more expansive than what he had for his first one. It looks like there's an inconsistency there. And I have to take a look also at which clause. It says clause 3. Is it clause 3 on page 1, which changes all identification for registration? Or is it just the second part? But the issue, members, is very simple. We passed HAVA last year and did the conforming language for HAVA. We did it to try to get as simple as possible, as straightforward as possible, between how we register at the polls and keeping those lists identical. And so that's the issue that's coming forward. And so right now, we're not looking at expanding that government list. However, we're looking at allowing some other issues that are coming from government, like property tax statements, et cetera, along with our current IDs. That question was raised, and that question was there. I also have a couple of other areas in the amendment that I thought we need clarification on and need to take a really close look at, Mr. Chair. And that's on page 2, lines 22 through 40, 24 through 30. I'd like to look at lines 24 through 30. Here's where my clarification is. Notice all the different things under there for photo identification. And it says, for this purpose, it's for the purpose of Clause 3. As I read Clause 3, that's registration on the first page. And what that does then, it's not technically a government-issued ID anymore. We have now changed that to be an employer, a bank, a credit card company, a college, a university, a high school, or a business for its membership program. So there's a number of more IDs that are going back to page 1, because it says it's been actually used for registration now. And there's an inconsistency there, as I see one. I'll let you get a chance to respond. And then on page 3...
Mr. Kokoski, yes. I don't know if we actually have an amendment here. I'm wondering... rather than trying to rewrite this amendment, I thought we had this worked out. Is this something that you could maybe work on before this bill goes to the floor and see if there are ways to work through some of these issues prior to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We very much appreciate the working relationship we've had with Mr. Kilkowski and the Secretary of State's office. We've made many changes already, as I've highlighted. I just received these latest suggested changes this morning, a short time ago, and have only had a brief time to process some of this. I have some questions about some of the changes, not in a position to fully respond to all of the suggested changes at this point. So I would be happy to continue working with Mr. Kilkowski and the office to see if by the time this gets to the floor we can work out whatever other adjustments we need to make.
Senator Emmer, is that acceptable to you?
It would be, as long as the Secretary of State's office is comfortable with that. Otherwise, I'm prepared to make a brief oral amendment just on these two provisions.
Mr. Kukowski, would that be acceptable to you?
I would. Either way would work with me, but if it's a brief oral amendment, then we can also work on that, too. So if it's really brief, we could take the brief amendment and then work on the other issues between now and the floor.
President Emmer, how brief?
Very brief. Okay. I would move, with the Chair's permission, to replace lines 14 through 16 with the language that Deputy Secretary Kilkowski read, and then remove lines 24 through 30 on page 2.
Yes. Mr. Chair, point of order.
Representative Westman.
I don't remember hearing an amendment being moved, and I just think I'm thinking we need to move an amendment to have something to modify.
Representative Emmer, we could do this, although I kind of want something in writing, because what you read was rather lengthy.
We have it in writing, sir.
I would prefer that we work on this before the floor, if that's all right.
That's fine.
All right, thank you. There is an A6 amendment.
That is mine.
Is that yours as well,
yes,
Emmer?
This is the elections omnibus bill that passed this committee, and that goes through page 68, where Article 6 starts. Article 6 is House File 2116, which was the bill that was presented in this committee involving 527s. Has been amended since it left this committee in public safety significantly, in that the caps that were originally presented to this committee have been removed, and you will also note on page 72 that the caps for the statewide races have been increased. And again, that language was amended in the Public Safety Committee, and that's the way 2116 exists now.
Representative Emmer, this is the same as the earlier amendment.
Yes.
It is our elections omnibus bill that we passed, as well as your bill with some changes that we passed.
As well as the amended 2116 as it came back from Public Safety.
Representatives, who did I file it?
Mr. Johnson, Representative Emmer, so this amendment amends your bill into Representative Lanning's bill?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawick, it's both the elections omnibus bill and the amended version of 2116, which was my bill.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Broad's bill, your bill, and they're combining three bills. And so I'm just trying to, Mr. Chairman, sorry, it was late. I just don't understand.
Mr. Chairman, I believe you're correct.
Okay.
And as we had mentioned on the earlier one, it appears that the Senate is not going to pass the omnibus bill. We based our omnibus bill on what they asked us to put in the bill, and now they've kind of shut down over there for some reason on elections matters, according to Senator Weaker. So we're not sure what's going to happen, but we thought the lesson that we learned from Representative Kahn is the more places you put your own bills, the better off you are. So that's the plan here, I think. Discussion to the A6 amendment. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Emmer, I note here on page 72, the A6 amendment, starting in line 31. Is this something that, this appears to me anyway to be something new since it was amended in public safety, and maybe I'm just misremembering. Did we discuss before a $2,000 limit for independent expenditures by political party units?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that was in the original bill.
It was?
Yes.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slavik.
You know, we're here to do a hearing and to proceed, but it's very difficult for us to have the combining of three bills and try to figure out what is in them. And I guess we'll try to do that as quick as we can, but it would have... you probably understand our position. We have no time to absorb what the changes are. We didn't realize this was coming. So,
Representative Slavik, I learned last night that the Senate was not going to move forward, apparently, with their omnibus bill. And so we kind of tried to figure out what to do. This is what we've already passed. The omnibus bill we discussed and passed through this committee, as well as each of the individual bills in the omnibus bill. And then we also passed Representative Emmer's bill, and he has pointed out the two changes that are in it. So this is pretty much everything we've already heard. Ms. Fraser?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Representative Emmer. The Public Safety Committee, when they heard 2116, amended it substantially, with amending the elections provision substantially. And I guess I'm wondering if this bill is as it was passed by that committee or if it's been changed. There were some problems with the way it was when it was passed. For example, it still required that groups doing independent expenditures file a report within 48 hours of having done an independent expenditure. But the report no longer had to include the amount that was spent or in which race it was spent. So the report basically said, heads up, I've spent some money somewhere in Minnesota, which doesn't seem to be the best use of anyone's time since the report doesn't contain much information anymore. I was just wondering if it's been changed or...
President Emmer, I understood you'd already explained that it had been, but could you do that again?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Fraser, I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to. When you say it was significantly changed in public safety, the most significant changes involved taking out the caps. There were significant caps, as you will recall, in the original 2116 as drafted, as far as what individuals or entities could give to campaigns. I believe they were $100, $500, $1,000 annual caps. Those were all removed in public safety, and then there was some adjustment on the first page where it said communication. That was adjusted so that it's restricted now to broadcast communication, so that written communications were not covered. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're referring to?
Ms. Brady.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer. No, I wasn't specifically referring to that change. Can you refer me in A6 to where 2116...
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Fraser, as I said earlier, it starts on page 68. It's Article 6.
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Ms. McKnight?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I think the provision that Ms. Fraser is looking for, just to change page 70, line 30, and then it appears again page 71, line 12. Those sentences were removed in public safety. We realized they didn't need to be removed to achieve the purpose that was going on there and they've been
included. I'm sorry, Ms. McKnight, Mr. Chairman, what lines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, page 70, line 30,
yep.
And then page 71, line 12, is the sentence that really was accidentally deleted as part of the other changes that happened in public safety.
Right.
And it comes in two places because there's an earlier and a later independent expenditure. So that's why it appears twice.
Does that answer the question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer.
Further discussion to the A6 amendment. Seeing none, Representative Emmer moved the A6 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No. No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any further discussion on 2226 as amended? Representative Lanning, anything further?
No, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for your reconsideration and moving this bill forward.
I will renew my motion that House File 2226 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you. We're going to wait just a couple minutes for Representative Davids. He was just here and stepped out. I will move House File 2075 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Okay, very briefly, what we're doing here is this bill, House File 2075, ensures that pharmacies are not contractually denied the right to pass on additional fees, expenses, or charges resulting from the wholesale drug distributor tax. Now, what this has to do with, it has to do with pharmacy benefit managers, where you have the 2% tax. They're charged a 2% tax, and then the pharmacies are supposed to be able to pass that through. That's what current law states. Some pharmacy benefit managers are not allowing that to happen. Now, most of them are. The state of Minnesota pharmacy benefit managers are doing it right, but there are a few out-state pharmacy benefit managers that are not complying with current law. And what this bill does, it says, yeah, but this time we really mean it.
Okay?
That's the bill. And I've got some folks here that could help answer questions. But that's all we're doing. We're clarifying current law to say that the pharmacies can pass this through and the pharmacy benefit managers do have to pay it.
All right. Discussion or questions on the bill? Is there anyone?
Mr. Chairman, I'm
Representative Davids.
We do have an amendment.
Oh, yes. I will move the A050539 amendment.
And if I could have the witness here testify to the amendment briefly.
All right. Please introduce yourself and give some testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Johnson. I'm a pharmacist, and I'm also the Executive Vice President for the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. I appreciate the opportunity to speak real briefly about House File 2075. As Representative Davids just explained to you, this legislation is intended to ensure that Minnesota pharmacies who incur additional expenses as a result of the wholesale drug distributor tax are not contractually precluded from exercising their option to transfer this expense onto all third-party contracts. Minnesota statute expressly states that pharmacies may transfer the expenses related to this tax. and also as Representative David states, the largest pharmacy benefit management firms allow the transfer of this expense. Minnesota firms don't have a problem with it. However, pharmacists are reporting in an increasing number to us that many PBMs firms are operating operating outside Minnesota are refusing to pay the tax. In reading the statute, it's clear the legislative intent was that pharmacies be allowed to either transfer these additional expenses onto third-party contracts or adjust their fees to recover the costs. House File 2075 ensures that pharmacies are not contractually precluded from exercising their option. What's happening is the contracts that we get in the pharmacies, we get in the mail, it's a take it or leave it contract. So for us to say we'll take the contract, but this part about the not being able to pass the 2% tax on or recover that, we can't do that. We can't change those contracts any time that we write on there, everything's fine in this contract and I want to participate and serve the patients in my area. But the 2% tax thing is a Minnesota law and we have to recover that. The contract is null and void. So because of our inability to negotiate the contracts at all, we can't address that issue. So as was stated, the intent is just to clarify that yes, indeed, they either have to pay the tax or allow us to tack the 2% onto what we collect. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about that, and I'd be happy to answer any more questions.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
And Mr. Chairman, I believe that the amendment just further clarifies what we're trying to do here.
All right, so this puts it in the form that you would prefer.
Yes.
All right, the 805-0539 amendment is before us. Any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any questions or discussion on the amended bill? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Davis, over to the testifier, can you give an example of the organizations that are drafting them into the contracts with increasing frequency? I just like to know who we're talking about.
Ms. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I can give you the names of the companies. We actually are keeping a list at the association office of the companies that are refusing to pay the tax. I can't list them right off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to provide those to you.
Okay.
Representative Lesh?
Yeah, thank you. That'd be adequate. Unless you could think of any Minnesota companies right now, otherwise just provide a list if you're able to.
I'll be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Further discussion? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2075 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
All right, Representative Finstead, House File 1879. Welcome to the committee. I'll move House File 1879 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This has been a week-long journey to get this bill in front of this committee, of being on again and off again of the agenda, so I appreciate the time to be here this morning. House File 1879 is the formal board, campaign finance board recommendations. And what I want to do, I think, in the interest of time and accuracy of information, I think I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Olson with the Campaign Finance Board, and she will go over this bill in detail and then be available for questions. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Ms. Olson, if you could introduce yourself for the record and tell us about the bill.
Christine Olson, Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. As Representative Finstead said, this is the board's formal recommendations and the substantive one. Representative Hilty's technical bill is rolled into the omnibus bill, I think. The first section requires that political committees, funds, and party units that raise or spend in excess of $15,000 would have to file their reports with us electronically, not necessarily using the board's electronic filing mechanism, but some mechanism so that we can just download it into our databases. We have found that most folks that are raising and spending in excess of $15,000 are keeping their records electronically anyway. They print them off on a paper copy, give them to us, and we data enter them. It would be easier and quicker disclosure if we got them in an electronic form. Section 2 provides that a pre-election report is due only for the election that a candidate is on the ballot. In other words, this works that if somebody loses in the primary, they don't have to file the pre-general report. There doesn't appear to be any political purpose to file a pre-general report when you have lost in the primary and your name is not going to be on the ballot. Those are the folks that often get in trouble with us because they don't think they have to file it, and so it would be nice if they didn't have to file it. Section 3 reduces the amount for 48-hour notices for constitutional officers. In 1993, the legislature reduced the contribution limits for constitutional officers and didn't reduce the amount for the 48-hour notice. So as it's currently written, the contribution limits are lower than what they have to report on a 48-hour notice. So this just brings the 48-hour notice down more in line with what legislators are reporting. Section 4 provides that if somebody wants to terminate their committee, they may and they have debt, they may do that if they send notice to their debtors that they're going to terminate their principal campaign committee. This provides that if somebody does that to get rid of debts and re-registers a principal campaign committee within 4 years, they have to go back and assume those debts again. We have instances where candidates have debts for an office, terminate their principal campaign committee, and almost immediately after re-register for the same office. So this just seems to make people a little more accountable for campaign expenditures. Section 5 changes from 6 years to 4 years the required termination. Candidates are required to terminate now within 6 years after they last served in office or ran for office. This would just change it to 4 years, which would be appropriate for all legislative and constitutional office candidates. The only people that may be harmed by this would be judicial candidates, because they run every 6 years. But most judicial candidates get in and out of the system at their election time and terminate their registration immediately after the election anyway. Section 6 has to do with the first-time candidates. First-time candidates are defined as anybody who has ever run at any time.
Ms. Olson?
Yes.
Representative Weston, we had a question.
I'll wait until she's done, Madam.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to get on the list.
All right, that's fine. Okay. I'm sorry, Ms. Olson, keep going.
This would provide that if they have run more than 10 years before they're running again, they could be a first-time candidate provided they meet the population thing. So if it's been more than 10 years, there's been a redistricting in that meantime, that they maybe don't have the name recognition, which is one of the reasons for first-time candidacy increases. Section 7 provides that if a pre-primary report filed by a candidate doesn't disclose contributions equal to or greater to the amount required in the affidavit of contributions for a House candidate, that would be $1,500 from individuals. If the pre-primary report doesn't disclose that, this would say that when they file the affidavit of contributions on September 1st, they would provide to the board a list of the names and addresses of the individuals who they're claiming they got contributions from. That data would be private data on individuals because it's below the threshold for reporting. But each election year we have candidates who run and on their pre-primary report they show zero or no contributions received through August 23rd, and then on September 1st they file an affidavit saying they've gotten $1,500. Quite often we never hear from those people again. We have to pay them public subsidy. There's nothing that allows us to withhold public subsidy payments. And so this would say if the report doesn't show it, then you'd have to provide additional information to do that.
Mr. Chair, on that point.
Representative Western.
Mr. Chair, rather than wait till the end on this one, Ms. Olson, why don't we just line the dates up of those two reports so they're both on September 1st, or I felt this when I fill out campaign committees, you fill out your report, and then a week later you've got a affidavit that you've received enough money. Can you line that up, or do we have to line that up for you?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, further on in the bill, there's an alternative to this provision that says that the affidavit of contributions would have to be filed when the pre-primary report is filed, so that we could relate them to each other. The negative on that, and the reason that hasn't passed before, I think, is because it cuts down by about 10 days the amount of time folks need to, might need to raise the affidavit money. Now, if you wanted to make them both September 1st, the problem, a couple years ago, the legislature moved the date for the pre-primary report back. It used to be 10 days before the primary, and they moved it back to be 15 days before the primary to ensure that it would be filed before Labor Day. So many treasurers were complaining that they were working Labor Days and filing the reports. But and I don't know how early an election could be, but if the pre-primary report were to come in on September 1st, I'm not sure that gives the public a lot of time to review the reports before they make their voting decisions.
Okay. Jim Wester?
Well, so the only downfall would be is the affidavit of contributions. You'd have to have your $1,500 raised in a House race, as an example, 7 or 10 days earlier than what we currently allow.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wester, yes, that's correct. But that is an alternative to providing the additional data.
Okay. So just to clarify that, Mr. Chair, then you're saying that both processes will be allowed still, or we're going to give an alternative? I'm unclear on what's going to happen next year when
the
reports come out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, the board would suggest you do one or the other. Either could have them give them till September 1st and have them provide the extra disclosure, or require the affidavit of contributions to be filed with the pre-primary report of reconsideration.
And Westrom?
So the board's saying we should decide that, and we're really not. We're putting both ways in this bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative, both ways are in this bill at this time because the board wanted to offer both of them to the legislature so they...
We decide.
You could decide.
Okay.
Either works for the board.
Let's decide, yeah.
Ms. Olson, proceed.
Section 8 requires that a candidate file their pre-primary report before we pay public subsidy. Right now, there's not even that requirement. If somebody signs the public subsidy agreement and files an affidavit of contributions and never files a report, we still have to pay them public subsidy. So this just provides that we don't pay them public subsidy until at least we see the pre-primary. Section 9 provides the affidavit of contributions, and this is where this is a provision that would make it due the same date as the pre-primary report. And it also provides that the affidavit of contributions in a special election, candidates in a special election would have to raise less money. It's very difficult in a special election to raise that $1,500 because they usually have about 4 days to do it, because it counts from the date of the special election through the day after they have to file for office. This says that they still have to raise some money, and those dates are still pertinent, but the money is less. For instance, a House candidate would only have to raise $500 instead of the $1,500 to qualify to get public subsidy payments in a special election. And that, Mr. Chair, is the board's substantive recommendation.
All right. Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, back to the two other points that I had, Ms. Olson. First, on the judge filing, is that only if a judge doesn't want to keep their committee active that it would terminate in 4 years? So let's say Representative Broad runs for a judicial spot, gets it, and she could only, the provision would only terminate her campaign committee if she didn't keep it renewed, or would she not be able to keep a campaign committee open for 6 years?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it would require her to terminate it within 4 years most judicial candidates do, because they don't have any activity in the period between the 6 years. Now, I do understand that that might be a problem, and if the legislature would decide, you could say that it's 4 years for legislative and constitutional office candidates and 6 years for a judicial candidate. That would seem to help. I think the only judicial candidate we have currently registered with us is Justice Black.
Okay. It seems to me, Mr. Chair, committee members, that we maybe should do that. Just one of the reasons I would argue for that is just it seems like we don't have much of an elected judiciary anyways, and to just not have our election laws conform with their cycles would seem a little silly. But anyway, my next question, Representative Olson, we can come back to the judiciary as a committee, but did I understand you right? Does current law give a campaign committee protection from businesses or bills that they run up and wouldn't get paid at the end of the election if they terminate their committee? Or, because you said if they terminate their committee and they give notices to their businesses if they're terminating, does that give them liability protection from individual liability to those debts?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair, no, it does not relieve their debt. It just allows them to terminate their registration with the board. However, by the time that has happened in these 6 years, I'm not an attorney, but it seems to me the statute of limitations has probably run on that. So 4 years makes it more reasonable for that also.
Okay.
They have to notify the businesses by certified mail that they are terminating their registration, although the statute says this does not extinguish the debt.
Okay, so the campaign committee candidate likely is going to personally be liable either way, and always has been, always probably will be.
Ms. Olson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, yes.
All right, Representative Gina Forrest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for either the author or Ms. Olson. On line 16 on page 1, referring to the $15,000 threshold for electronic filing, I assume that's in an election cycle or a calendar year?
Mr.
Ms. Olson.
Representative Delaforce, it's a calendar year.
Okay, in a calendar year. Mr. Chairman, if I may add a couple other questions. Yes. Thank you. Question for the author, maybe Ms. McKnight, on the effective date. If we were to adopt 1879, when would this become effective?
Ms. McKnight.
Mr. Chair, Representative Delaforce, right now there is no special effective date, so it's August 1st, unless there's something that you want to make immediate or delay in case maybe.
Thank you.
Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Olson, a question with respect to policy. See that we've lowered some of the things I see in here, like subdivision 1B with electronic filing, have, I'm sure, as one of the public purposes, a streamlining to reduce paperwork and time your staff spends on handling paperwork. But some of them, such as the lower threshold, I see as raising the amount of work that your staff might do. And I'm curious as to the public policy, especially in times when obviously we face tight budgets. I think you would readily agree that your office, like everybody else, is facing restrictions as well in terms of staff. And I'm just wondering about the extra burden that that your office is going to face with lower thresholds and more people reporting more things.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Delaforce, the lowering of the thresholds in the 48-hour notice just brings it down into line with where it used to be before they lowered the contribution limits, and the public policy purpose is so that voters have a right to know where candidates are getting their last-minute money from. You folks have to report when you get over $400 during that two-week time. Secretary of State, State Auditor, and Attorney General don't have to report any 48-hour notices, and the governor only has to report it if he gets the maximum $2,000. So the board feels that the added burden of disclosure, or added burden on the staff, is worth it for public disclosure.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just one more. And then under Section 9, there is a requirement now added that I didn't hear you address in your testimony regarding affidavits of contribution being signed and notarized. Is there some type of problem that your office has encountered that would merit having the candidate. Now, one more thing to do to go try and find somebody to notarize the darn thing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Della Forest, we've already, it's always required to be notified. It's an affidavit. Affidavits have to be notarized. We've always had it notarized, and the reviser must have just put this in to make it clear. But we have a notary on staff, and it's always been notarized.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. That's exactly my question. If it's an affidavit, I don't know. It's picayune, I guess, but I was curious as to why we put the language in there to say you got to have it notarized when it's an affidavit in the first place. All right. Thank you.
Further discussion to the bill. Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Finstein, can you give me a little bit of, or maybe even Ms. Olson, regarding the discussion in the Senate in which they moved that $15,000 up to $50,000, if you could just discuss that.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, as the board recommended this, that didn't get in the bill, it was going to cover everybody, candidates also. And then when it was introduced in both the House and Senate, it was just taxed as party units. They felt that if $15,000 was a little low, they were concerned about the party units, the House districts, the Senate districts, that some of those folks aren't politically savvy. They moved it up to $50,000because we believe, the board believes, that at $15,000, most people are using some sort of processor to process their contributions anyway. But at $50,000, you know, they generally are. So the Senate thought $50,000 was a better amount. I have information from other states if you're interested in what they require, but the Senate did put in $50,000. I would opine that any amount would be good if we could start with any amount and get that down there, the public would know quicker what was going on.
Well,
Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess I would be interested in what the other states are doing, but I also would be interested in the definition of most. When you say most are doing it, can you just give me a rough percentage ballpark? Does that mean, you know, over 50%? Is it 80%? What is most?
Results.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, they all come in typed at least, and if that's off of a spreadsheet or off of something, but at least it's off of a word processor, and so that even would be, if they'd give us that, even would, that would even work. And excuse me, I didn't hear what you said about other states. You're not interested in
that? I am.
Oh, I have, there's about 20 or 25 other states that require electronic disclosure. Arizona requires electronic disclosure by everyone, no bottom threshold, any amount they raise or spend. California, it's $50,000, but it's everybody. It's candidates, PACs, party units. Connecticut is the highest at $250,000. Florida has no threshold. Georgia, it's $20,000 for statewide and $10,000 for legislative candidates. Hawaii, it's $5,000 for statewide and voluntary for legislative candidates. Illinois, it's $10,000. Louisiana is $50,000 statewide and voluntary for legislative. Same with Massachusetts. Maryland requires all. Michigan is $25,000. Missouri is $15,000 for statewide and voluntary for legislative. New York, it's everybody. Ohio, $10,000. Oregon, $50,000. Rhode Island, $5,000. Texas, everyone. Virginia is voluntary for legislative and no threshold for statewide. State of Washington, $10,000, and our neighbor Wisconsin, $20,000. And that's on the rise. The national organization does believe that for states that are just starting to mandate electronic filing, that they do start higher so that we get the system in place before we move it down to less active campaigns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it sounds like the approach that you're proposing here today then is deemed reasonable within the guidelines of what you're saying the other states are doing. I would maybe ask you, is there a way to extend out the deadline to get some of these folks the opportunity to work towards something versus drop it on them and require them to do it? Maybe that's something we can work on, is extending that out a little bit. And then the other question I guess I had is in regards to Section 4, I think. That's the piece where after 4 years of office, let's see, I don't want to paraphrase it. My question really is that shouldn't those liabilities carry over even if the person runs for a different office?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, there is permissive language in the statute that allows candidates who are running for another office to transfer the debt to the other one, but I think it might be difficult for somebody who's got some debt from running for the House and now wants to run for the Senate to start the Senate campaign with debt. They are deemed to be two separate committees. You need two separate bank accounts. It's two separate entities. This doesn't extinguish their debt. They still have to pay it.
Well, and I guess, Mr. Chair, that's where my question follows, is that it really is the committee's debt until it becomes the person's debt, is what I hear you saying. And if it's the person's debt, then no matter what they decide to run for next, it's their debt and it follows them. So I guess I'm not sure why that shouldn't be carried into the next committee. I guess I still have some concerns over that piece.
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, well, you could change that to say, and who registers any other committee. Well, you don't even, I guess what I'm hearing is you don't even want them to be able to terminate with existing debt. You want them to stay in the system?
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I guess I don't want to change it on the fly because I guess I have some concerns, but I'm not exactly sure where specifically I would want to go. So maybe I can have some conversations with you and Representative Finstad in regards to how to change that to make it work without changing it to a way that actually doesn't work. So maybe, Mr. Chair, I'll just have those conversations separate from this.
Further discussion. There is an A1 amendment. I don't know whose that is.
Mr. Chair, that's my amendment.
Representative Dean, did you want to offer that amendment?
I would like to move the A1 amendment.
All right. Representative Dean moves the H1879A1 amendment. Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, members, this amendment deals with corporations, membership associations, and labor organizations, and what it does is it allows those groups to communicate more easily with their members and also deals with the use of contributions directly for political purposes. And this was brought to me by the Minnesota Chamber, and we have Mike Franklin with us today, and maybe he could come up and also address the bill very briefly and also answer any questions that folks have about that.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Franklin. Introduce yourself for the record and give us your thoughts.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Mike Franklin. I manage the Political Action Committee for the Minnesota Chamber, and we did bring this to Representative Dean. Basically, what we're looking at is making changes to the way that Minnesota law regulates the way a corporation, membership association, or labor union can communicate with its executive staff and members, and how a political committee is administered in the state. And basically both items in the amendment are bringing us closer to the way the FEC governs political committees and membership associations. We kind of see this as having two major two good points. So one, it brings every political committee, makes Minnesota treat them more fair across the board to the donors and across the board with all political committees, and also establishes a level of consistency with federal law so that donors aren't confused when their money can be spent one way under state law, one way under federal law, and they can hear one set of communication on federal candidates and one on state candidates. In other words, we support this. We ask for your support, and happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions or discussion on the A1 amendment? Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against this amendment? All right, seeing no discussion, Representative Dean renews his motion on the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any further discussion on 1879 as amended? It is good. Okay. I understand Representative Westrum has an amendment, and he's right outside the door here. Representative Westrum, I understand you might have an oral amendment.
Mr. Chair, I do. I guess I'd just be interested in other committee members' perspective, but I wouldn't see the downside of making a judicial candidate committee 6 years, which would be consistent with the judicial term. And Ms. McKnight, do you have a way we could modify that?
Ms. McKnight.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Westrum, I think it would work, and the easiest or the shortest way to do this without repeating everything to the judges, I think, is on page 3, line 12, after the word years, would insert comma, or in the case of candidates for judicial office, 6 years, comma.
I move that amendment,
and
Mr.
Then,
excuse
me, Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, one other place, because there's two ways they can terminate their campaigns, or two ways it becomes inactive, I'm sorry. Page 3, line 16, after the word years, the same insert. So if I could, for Representative Westrum's benefit, it would be when 4 years, or in the case of candidates for judicial office, 6 years, have elapsed since the last day. That's the sentence.
Okay. All right. Representative Westrum makes that motion. Discussion. Jim Finstad, any thoughts?
I see that as a friendly amendment. It makes sense.
All right. All those in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion fails. The amendment is adopted. Further discussion on 1879. President Brock.
I just have one more question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Thank you very much. I've just been thinking a little bit more about that termination issue. And I guess I might be more inclined to say that they should not be allowed to terminate if there's still outstanding debts to be paid. So maybe that's something, again, we can talk about. I just wanted to bring it up a little bit more formally, but that might be the way to go about it, as opposed to just exempting it out.
Mr. Chair, what we find is candidates who have outstanding debt move out of the state, and we never hear from again, and we beg after them with letters. These aren't generally folks who are going to get back in the system, and it's hard for us to find them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm glad to have a conversation with you.
Representative Western.
Mr. Chair, just a question. Did anything get decided on the August filing, September 1st filing decision, or what is the committee's thoughts on that, or Representative Finstead's thoughts? Are we going to, when is that going to get decided? Are we going to try to decide one way or the other, or just let both provisions?
Representative Finstead?
Mr. Chair, the Senate.
Ms. Olson.
The Senate chose the option of including additional disclosure so that it wouldn't decrease the time that individuals had to raise the money. So I don't know if you want to go with that, or if you want to pick the other one, and then you can talk about it in the conference.
It seems to me, Mr. Chair, that we should align the dates. I don't know if that would be an easy amendment to do, or Representative Finstead, if you'd have objection to that.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, to align it to what the Senate did, you mean?
No, to align it to the pre-primary report, and the affidavit to me should be sent in on the same day, which would be August 23rd or...
Then, excuse me again, Mr. Chair. The amendment would be to delete lines on page 5, leave in the old language and remove the new language. This is nice.
With line 2,
I'll give Ms. McKnight a minute.
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrum, I think that works at this.
Removing.
Mr. Chair and Ms. McKnight, I think we want to keep the deleted language deleted. That was old language from 1993, I think. We only have it doesn't allow for multiple affidavits.
Oh, no, you're right. So Mr. Chair and Ms. Olson, then just removing the language on page 5, line 7 to 13. And then the change to Keith is the change on page 7, right? Is that right?
Mr. Chair and yes.
Ms. Olson. So, Representative Westrum, if you agree with this, I believe you want to move to delete the new language, page 5, lines 7 through 13, mm-hmm. as well as, I assume, the word if on line 2.
Yes.
All right. That motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, I'll...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilke.
So if this... Could Ms. Olson point us to where in the bill this issue is covered then?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilke, it's on page 7, line 14, requires that the affidavit of contributions then be filed on the date the pre-primary report of receipts and expenditures is due. Page 7, line 14 to 16.
And Ms. Olson, the Senate chose the opposite choice. Maybe
Chair,
opposite.
That's correct.
Okay, so we would discuss that in comments. Yes. All right. Hilty? Mm-hmm. Any further discussion? The amendments. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, I will remove my motion that House File 1879 as amended be recommended to pass and placed on the general rules. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any more? That's right. Our last vote of the season, unless we meet again. House File 127, I will move House File 127 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Welcome to the committee, Representative Abel.
You see, I've got your favorite bill here. I knew Brooklyn Bay and it could be our favorite case, and I said, really, you're the last one, so that's Mr. Chair, somebody would move the House File 127 recommended to pass and be referred to the Health Committee.
Okay, I will change my motion that House File 127 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health.
And this should be an amendment as well as the 0560 amendment.
All right, I will move the 805-0560 amendment. That amendment is before us, Representative Abel.
Mr. Chair, I'll describe the amendments and then we can go to the bill and then do what you like.
All right.
Since you're the chair. That's anyway. This amendment was serving to clarify what the bill does and doesn't do. And do you want to talk through the whole bill or do you want me to put the context for the amendment?
Yeah, Representative Abel, why don't you explain the bill to us and then maybe explain how the amendment would change it since I think it may be significant.
Well, just to save time, I'll turn to my witness who will probably have a nice succinct presentation prepared. So.
All right. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Florey and I represent the American Cancer Society. Really, we brought this bill forward because we've seen similar legislation passed in other states and thought it was a good idea, a good way to solve a number of problems. Really, every year, cancer patients and their families are left with unused cancer drugs, either after they've completed a course of treatment, a treatment that was prescribed turns out not to be as effective with them, or after a member of the family has died of cancer. And currently there's nothing that can be done with these drugs. They need to be destroyed. What a number of states have done is drugs to be donated back to a voluntary drug repository and then made available to uninsured people, low-income folks, to basically provide some place for these drugs to be recycled and another option for providing drugs to people without insurance. Really, we believe that this is a good program. It has been passed in about 9 states. We've been working with Representative Abler to really define the process for this program to make sure that we lay out a clear standard for those participants that choose to voluntarily participate in the program. And in terms of making sure that they inspect drugs so that we know that we're only accepting unused, unopened drugs, that they have not passed their expiration date, that we're also providing a donor notification form so that people recognize that they're receiving donated drugs. And then finally, that we provide reasonable liability protection for those people that participate in the program in good faith, so that participation doesn't expose them to additional liability. This is something that that has been approved in other states, and we believe that with this amendment, we'll significantly tighten up the liability provision in the bill, actually be a little tighter than what we are in other states. so that people that are, like I said, participating in good faith are not exposing themselves to additional liability in exchange for really providing a service to the community.
All right. What's the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Abler or the witness, I don't understand how any liability restrictions or immunities could be reasonable under this situation when you just testified that we're talking about unused, unopened drugs. If that's what we're talking about, why would the manufacturer be allowed to avoid responsibility? Why would the medical facility or the pharmacy avoid responsibility? It's a great concept. And I agree with that part wholeheartedly, but I have a huge problems with these constant carve-outs of liability.
Representative Abel?
Mr. Chair, this has been the most difficult, cute little bill I ever you saw. You know, why the situation is currently, if a pharmacist were tending to the deathbed of his neighbor and actually pick up the medications, put them in the closet himself, and they were stored perfectly, he's disallowed from giving those to somebody else, even though he's had total control. He would lose his either his license or his insurance coverage. That's the problem. And so how do you go about this? And the problem that remains unanswered by even this bill is you don't know about the quality of the product. An example of the pharmacist who's tending to his friend, you can be assured that those are good quality medications and packaging and all that. That's the best of the situations, and he's disallowed. You don't know if someone left them on their windshield in the dash and they got heated up. Some of these drugs could be liable to heat changes, or someone left them somewhere there. You know, and that's the trouble. One thing that nobody can attest to is the quality of the product. And in the bill, the base bill that you have in front of you, is language where the pharmacist should use due diligence, expiration dates, packaging, inspecting them to see if they've been tampered with, etc., to assure that the client, the user, that they're likely safe. We created a donor form so that the donor would attest to how they've been stored, at least reduce the heat issues. The donee, the recipient, has to acknowledge that they've been notified that they may not be safe. These are the kinds of people that wind up with these drugs. They're going to get nothing or this. And odds are going to say that these are safe, but they cannot be assured to be safe. And so the manufacturer who's manufacturing the product has liability that if you read the first part of the amendment, which is to the point of the question, Representative Emmer, to the amendment now on lines, page 194 through 13, the manufacturer is exempt only from things that happen after their time of reasonable control. If it was a bad batch of drugs to start with, they're still on the hook. If it was a bad drug to start with, that wasn't even a bad batch, they're still on the hook. And so if there's a class action lawsuit that happens and they had made a drug that was not at all suitable for the condition, these people still get the money from that, I would suppose. They'd be part of that class. All that this says is if this group of people doesn't do well, they can't go back and say that it was your fault because it was left in the sun or somebody, it was actually not the product that it was to be. And I think it's very, very narrow. If you read the language on lines 8 and 9, the intentional and unintentional alteration of the drug by a party not under control of the manufacturer, that really isn't their liability matter. The second is the failure of a party not under their control to tell people about all these disclosures they're supposed to tell them really isn't the drug company's problem. Every other thing that they could be liable for, they're still liable for. So it's a very narrow carve-out. To the second point, and to the amendment, actually, it's a good opportunity to describe it. The second has to do with the pharmacy dispensing. And the pharmacy dispensing and the pharmacist dispensing have quite a list of things they have to do in the bill about protocols to follow. And so the person who's getting them has an informed consent that they know what they're getting may or may not be valuable in terms of the quality. There is a gap, though, Mr. Chair, what we were discussing in the audience, which was unintentional. I don't think we can fix it here, but I've assured that Mr. Carlson and the cancer folks have assured each other that we're going to try to clean up one gap, and it's unintentional. What we did in the language, just so you know, there's been, I think if the first part of the language doesn't stay in the bill, might as well just make your last, just put it in the shredder now, because I think it's important to make sure that manufacturers are protected from what wasn't their fault.
I think you've been very narrow on that. And the focus of the debate has been about taking that out and then dealing with the second paragraph. I think when the paragraphs are separated, a negotiation can go on better to tighten up what I'll tell you about. Right now, under the bill, it seems as though if a nurse should inject a nerve and cause a paresthesia that's permanent, using a donated drug, she's exempt from malpractice. That's not our intention. We merely intend to exempt anybody from malpractice or claims about the quality of the drug that's donated. That's the pure point of the exemption language, which is out of control of anybody. If a doctor would prescribe the wrong drug, and the drug that they gave in the package was the wrong one, and they die from that or something, because it was the wrong drug, that's not a matter of protection from this bill. It's only if the drug they gave was the proper drug and the dosage recommendations were correct, but it happened to be a bad supply because of post-manufacturer issues. Would they be exempt from those that narrow claim? And so, Mr. Chair, this language does not accomplish that as well as we thought it did, especially given the challenge about the other language. So before this bill becomes law, this is going to go to the omnibus, and the Senate has a little different version, and I assure you that there'll be language worked out along the way to address that. And we can report back to you if you'd like.
All right.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that detailed answer, Representative. I do appreciate it, but in giving that answer, you actually raised a much bigger problem with the overall bill that I hadn't even contemplated. When I heard this legislation in the Health Committee, again, I think it's a great concept. Let's use the drugs for people that are still here that can use them. Great concept. But the problem is, now you're talking about the quality of what we're going to be giving them. And you just said, and I'd forgotten all about this, that whoever donates these drugs, because as we heard in the Health Committee, people pass away and they leave large quantities of unused drugs that we want to make available. Well, they're not around to tell us where those drugs have been. You're going to actually ask somebody else who's going to be donating them to say these have been well maintained. And when you say that, you know, we can't guarantee quality and we want to make sure that we protect these folks just in case somebody did let them sit in the sun too long, that raises even bigger problems if you can't maintain the chain of command or the chain of custody from day one. I'm not comfortable with it at all, but I do appreciate the response.
Representative Abler? Mr. Flory?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the chain is a pertinent issue, and really the concern that we have is that we do everything possible to demonstrate the value or that the drugs are as good as we can verify. The problem is we need some level of liability just in that just in case situation, and whether or not we meet this, we've attempted to meet as high a standard as we can. I'm not sure if we'll meet a standard that satisfies you, but the standard we've tried to meet involves laying out a process where the pharmacist can inspect the drug to the best of their ability to make sure that there's no expiration, that it has been misbranded. In addition to that, we ask the donors to complete a form, and I believe it's on page 4. The donor form must be provided by the commissioner and shall state to the best of the donor's knowledge that the donated drug or supply has been properly stored and that the drug or supply has never been opened, used, tampered with, adulterated, misbranded. So in other words, we're trying to provide every step that we can. The trade-off here is that if we don't provide these drugs or we don't do something to recycle them, they will be destroyed. So we are trying to create some sort of balance.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, and then I'll be done.
Fine, Representative Emmer.
Sir, what you just said, if you listen to your words, are the whole reason why we shouldn't be doing this at all. You just responded to me by saying, you know, our intent is good, but we're putting language in the bill for this liability for the just in case. Because my question to you is going to be, well, what's good enough? How much is enough? For your response is we need this liability protection just in case what we're proposing isn't good enough and something slides through. I have no problem with the intent. I think the intent is very honorable. But I don't believe that if there's any chance that we could have some bad drug getting through and somebody gets injured or there are consequences that we don't expect, that we're supposed to protect the program. I think our job on this side is supposed to protect those people. So I do respect what you're doing, but I don't agree.
Mr. Chair, and I we're free to disagree, and we may at the end of this day. The counterpart is this bill actually came from Senator Solon, who passed away. Her husband passed away, and she had these drugs left. And what if she finally just threw them away? And throwing drugs away, where do you put them? Down the sewer? Well, you can't do that. That's a water supply issue. You put them in the garbage can. So that, you know, and so there's all kinds of questions that swirl around this whole matter. The Canadian importing issues and, you know, getting them from foreign pharmacies is the argument that's, you know, are they safe to get these from some foreign pharmacy? And that's people have different positions on this committee even about that. I think that having weighed the pros and the cons, I also want to remind you of the high-level professionalism of the pharmacists who will be receiving these things. They're not going to, if some person comes in who, these are often to be donated by nurses and the aides who have been serving these individuals in a hospice. You think about the population. Personally, I'm comfortable that there's going to be, you know, probably no instances of bad drugs. But that you can't say without certainty. So because there's no certainty, you provide that the people who do this Good Samaritan work will not find themselves in harm's way.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I hope that you can approve this and move it on and let the goodness go with you prevail. I'll stand for questions.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hiebler, Mr. Floyd, the Cancer Society is comfortable with the language of the 0560 amendment. Is that correct?
Mr. Flory?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. We feel that, and just to clarify intent, we're not looking for just in case to protect the program. We feel that the voluntary program needs to provide some assurance to participants in order to have volunteers. Otherwise, we'll have a program without volunteers. We're comfortable with the amendment because we feel that it really tightens up the liability language that was in the original bill.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Representative Abler detailed a fairly good and cogent argument for why we should be doing this. It's that I think the people who make the medicine realize how expensive it is for patients and for the state, and that we ought not throw that down the drain. I think that patients and their families see that this is a waste of dollars. I know my mom is going through very, very expensive chemotherapy and the drugs. You just cannot believe the individual dosing costs of that. And I think that this is something that just makes common sense to patients, to people who make the medicine, and to public policy. But we also have to realize that when we transfer from one patient to another, that there is another level of risk and exposure for the people who make these medicines. And I think that a provision like this needs to take that into account, and that we cannot ever successfully guarantee 100% risk-free, but we're dealing in an environment of cost containment where we simply can't afford to have those zero risks. So I like that language, and I like the fact that you're going to try to tighten that oversight up a little bit. But I think that that is a reasonable step, and it's something that we should do from a public policy perspective. I think it's a good idea.
Seeing no further questions, Mr. Carlson, I know that you expressed an interest in testifying with respect to the bill. Morning, Mr. Carlson, you know the drill. Identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson. I have a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota trial lawyers to indicate that we believe that House File 127 is a well-intentioned idea, and there are some safeguards that are in the first engrossment that weren't in the original bill. However, we believe, as written, it is still overly broad. It protects medical facilities and practitioners for their negligent care unfair. It places an unfair reliance on consumers based on the disclosures that are in the bill. And lastly, we believe it provides an absolute immunity for anyone involved in this particular program, regardless of the type of care, the quality of the drug. And in that respect, Mr. Chairman and members, we believe that it goes significantly too far. As to the bill itself, I want the committee to know that we are not just talking about cancer drugs. If you look at the definition on page one, you're going to find that a cancer drug means any prescription drug that is used to treat cancer or the side effect of cancer. We're talking about pain medication. All prescription medicine could fall under the rubric of this particular program, and it is not restricted to cancer patients. So you could donate a prescription that is to treat a side effect of cancer, whether it's pain medication or something else, and there is no restriction that that be used subsequently for, I don't believe, for simply treating cancer patients. A cancer supply, also on page one, is essentially anything else that is attendant to the prescription, and why supplies are under the rubric of this and how they are going to be inspected, I don't really know, but want you to know that this does not just impact cancer drugs. Want you to also know, Mr. Chairman and members, that if you look at the definitions, I believe it's on, or not definitions, but who qualifies on page four, bottom of page three and the top of page four, you'll see that protected by this protection in the bill are not just the individual donor who received the original prescription, but it also includes a pharmacy, a medical facility, a drug manufacturer, a wholesale drug distributor, if the donated drugs have not been previously dispensed. It does not include the situation that Representative Abler just discussed, which is the personal care attendant or someone else that is handling the drugs that maybe bring them in and donate them. So I don't even know that that person would be protected by the bill, and I don't know that we want them to be protected by this bill. Those prescription drugs are not in their care and possession, and how they would sign an affidavit saying that they know where the drugs have been would be an impossibility. Further in the bill, it requires a disclosure to the consumer, of which I believe they would rely on, that they've made every opportunity to inspect and that they have done everything required under the program and that the drugs have been donated and they've not expired, but it doesn't disclose to them that if you take these drugs and something is wrong with the quality or efficacy of the drug, that there's no liability to anybody. They don't disclose. They disclose to you in a way that makes you rely on what you're taking is appropriate, but they don't disclose to you that if we're wrong, nobody is responsible for it. We think that's wrong. On page six, the bill allows for a handling fee. We've talked in this committee at some length during the session about granting immunity to individuals that are getting paid for the service. Immunity is generally never given to those who are getting paid for doing the work. That's what we have professional negligence and malpractice for. They're in the business. They're making money at it. They shouldn't be given legal protection by the government. There is also no penalty to the pharmacist for actually taking in the drugs and reselling them. We've had a number of instances where pharmacists have either diluted or misappropriated cancer drugs. This legislation has no penalty for individuals that do that conduct, and we think maybe it should. And then as to the liability, Mr. Chairman, and I won't address the first engrossment, but the amendment that was before you, We don't see any reason for having manufacturers included in this bill in any way, shape, or form. They don't have any liability now once drugs are out of their possession, and we don't believe that including them in this bill makes any appropriate sense. As to lines 14 through the end of the amendment, to grant this protection to a facility, I understand that in certain circumstances a medical facility would be acting as the pharmacist. So there's potentially the opportunity to try and protect him. But this protects a practitioner administering the drug or supply pursuant to the program. And what that means is that they're exempt from their negligence. If they misprescribe, if they misadminister the drug, they are immune from liability, and we think that that is just an inappropriate use of governmental protection. We have a number of concerns, however well-intentioned this bill may be. We have a number of concerns about its potential impact. I am not aware of any circumstance, although the drugs are expensive, I'm not aware of any circumstance where people are being denied medication who are indigent, who are the intended recipients of these prescription medicines. I'd like to know the evidence of that before we grant this protection and what the use would actually be. Mr. Chairman and members, I would ask you to hang on to this bill. If it's going to be included in the omnibus human services bill, I want you to know that the Senate Judiciary Committee specifically did not address the issue of manufacturer liability. They didn't even raise it in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the Senate specifically excluded any professional or medical malpractice from any protection under this bill, and I fear that should the bill move forward in an omnibus package that that this committee doesn't track, that we're going to be unable to address those questions at some other juncture. And so I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman and members, but we have serious reservations about the bill as drafted.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. It's my understanding, members, as well, that we are still on the 0560 amendment, and we didn't have not voted on that. So procedurally, if there are there any further questions with respect to the 0560 amendment? Any questions or discussions? Okay, seeing none, we'll proceed to vote on the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The 0560 amendment is adopted, and now it's part of House File 127. Now, questions for Mr. Carlson with respect to the bill as amended. Representative Wesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I think you can help me understand this a little bit better. You're saying that on the top of page 4, those named entities, pharmacy, medical facility, drug manufacturer, wholesale drug distributor, that in this bill we extend to them protection from liability that they don't otherwise have under the current state of the law.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think that's absolutely the case.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carlson, this is where I'm understanding this. Because as I understand it right now, these people aren't getting these cancer drugs. So if they're getting them, or if they're not getting them, they don't have any liability now. And if they're getting them, they're not going to have any liability. So I guess I'm wondering how we're expanding the scope of the law, considering that this is a bill that, you know, would allow a situation to happen that wouldn't otherwise happen, that being that they're getting life-saving cancer treatment.
Mr. Carlson. Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesch, we have not been presented with information of patients who are not receiving the drugs, number one. We just haven't, other than anecdotal, we know there are people that could use these medications. We're unaware that the next step has been taken, that they aren't getting them, and that bad things are happening. Other than anecdotal evidence, that has never been presented to us. But we also know that these are highly toxic chemicals that require specific handling and storage and use requirements that we are now saying to the pharmacist, the practitioner, and the physician, even for prescribing it, do not have liability for anything that is donated through this program, whether it comes from a family member or a manufacturer. And that is certainly not the status of the law today. And until we know that there is a specific problem, and I have to tell you, I applaud the Cancer Society and Representative Abler for what they're trying to accomplish. But the amount and number of donated pharmaceuticals in this country is outstanding, and I just have been unaware that we need to take these drugs that have been prescribed for a specific patient and now recycle them as a cost containment issue. I just don't think the case has been made for that at all.
Okay. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, another question I have for you then, and this is a legitimate question, it's not a rhetorical question. I don't practice in the area of civil wrongful death. I'm not totally familiar with it. The last time I checked, cancer untreated was still fatal, unless I missed something in the newspaper recently. So if something were to happen, I understand there are other kinds of liability with these drugs other than someone taking a cancer medication that had been sitting on the dash of a car, heated up. But obviously, would be a little bit different. Cancer untreated is fatal, and the you take a drug and it was bad, and it leads to some other kind of sickness or whatever. Obviously, that is mitigated when you look at it from a legal perspective, considering someone was dying anyway. Is that correct?
Lynn, Mr. Carlson, Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Lesh. Minnesota does not recognize a loss of a chance of survival, whether you would have had a chance of surviving, whether or not you had received a medication or properly been diagnosed. We don't recognize that as a viable cause of action. Nothing is changing that relative to this bill. I can assure you that if there were cases where a certain medication was needed in a life-saving nature that only could be obtained through this donated program, it would be on Care 11 News. We'd be hearing about it. I'm saying that I don't think a case has been made that there is an unmet need that can only be met through this program and with this liability protection.
Well, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, I hear what you're saying, but every time I turn around, I hear about senior citizens having to decide whether or not they pay their rent or buy their medication or pay their utility bill or buy their medication. And I'm willing to bet that that's more pervasive than just arthritis medication, that it also includes some issues with respect to more serious ailments. So I hear what you're saying, but all the evidence out there I'm hearing about with respect to the cost of prescription drugs, that it is an issue.
Representative Abler, you wanted to chime in?
I'm not sure if I want to go into the debate, Mr. Chair. The policy of whether this should go forward or not would be a topic more germane to the Health Committee, which passed it out to this committee. It's here to discuss liability matters. But just since we're into the matter of efficaciousness of the bill and the need, the papers, depending upon whose, about who doesn't have coverage. Many people in Minnesota do not have any coverage. Over 6% do not. We're one of the better insured states in the country. However, some of the stories of people who have not been covered have been on the news. One woman in particular made a name for herself because she was unable to get the very drug she needed to cure her cancer. And so, members, there is a need, and just because someone says there's not doesn't mean there isn't. It's, you know, from your own constituencies and the challenges expressed by Representative Lesh pretty actually eloquently. Just to point out one other thing, or maybe two other things. The ability of pharmacies, medical facilities, drug manufacturers, etc., to donate drugs into this program actually would serve to dilute the possible bad quality. Now, just those, because they donate drugs to this program, the drugs they would donate to the program have to be a good quality because they're in control of those drugs. So I say they're more than merry. And this gives a venue for those companies to donate directly to these pharmacies should they want to do that. And one thing else, the only person who can get these products on page 3 is a Minnesota resident diagnosed with cancer. So maybe they're going to get some anti-nausea drug and get a painkiller. But these are Minnesota residents who have cancer, and they're even triaged on page. There's a triage list. There's a. You have to be uninsured, and then I don't know where that's in the bill. On page 6 it says, even the hierarchy. So they're trying to go after the health disparity populations and those who don't have another way to get these products. The uninsured is on page 9, line 6. Uninsured, and then people in the state subsidized programs, and then other people who would be there. So we try to serve the least served populations first of all. So members, I appreciate your support today.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a tough one for a lot of people, I think. I include myself in that. I really do believe that the aims of this legislation are truly great. And my only concern, I mean, this seems to pit two very legitimate values against one another, and that's compassion for the cancer patient and protection for that same cancer patient. I guess my concern for whoever wants to address it is my understanding is what the bill would do right now as drafted in terms of liability is it would say, for example, for a pharmacist, if the pharmacist is dispensing drugs to someone who's a multimillionaire, they are held to a negligent standard. If they're dispensing drugs to someone who is middle class, they are held to a negligent standard. If they are dispensing drugs to someone who is poor and can't afford it, then they are held to less than a negligent standard. And I don't know why we would, despite fantastic intentions, and believe me, my mother died of cancer, so it's very personal with me, but I'm not so sure why that's absolutely necessary. I mean, that's the sticking point for me, and why negligence would necessarily be, a negligent standard would necessarily torpedo the program. And I guess where I'm going with this is a question maybe for the author or Mr. Flory, who I've worked with before and have known for a long time and know that he's doing the right thing here. Are you really convinced that if we had a negligence standard in here, would it really torpedo the program? I mean, from what you know, even anecdotally, would people just absolutely not participate in this?
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, actually, I appreciate the question, and you found a point that needs some more work in this particular piece of legislation. The dialogue, just in terms of the tracking, in my opening comments about the amendment, you heard me say that that area needs some work. The reason it's not been worked on has actually been because just of the way processes go, there's concern about giving the manufacturers liability, which I think you need to do. If this bill goes forward, I think you need to protect the manufacturers in these two narrow instances, not from anything beyond those two narrow things beyond their control. And I think it's stating the obvious. But if you state the obvious and give them nothing new. The second part has to do with what I mentioned about how the provision of care and the recommendation of a particular product. The bill, as you approved today, is weak on that part, and it needs to be addressed. And I think there's a consensus, which occurred at the chairs that we were talking. We finally had a good dialogue about it. And there's a will on both part of the Cancer Society and myself to work with Mr. Carlson and his group to tighten that up to assure that it's not a matter of if they're negligent in their procedure, in their performance of their duties, that's not a protected event. What's protected is if they give out a drug they think is good based on their best judgment, and it's not a good product, but it should have been because it was somehow denatured. That's all we intend to protect, and so you have my assurance that that's the way it will go forward through the process.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, and members, a couple quick points. First, as a reminder, Minnesota only had 134 cases of medical malpractice filed in the entire state in 2004. This is not an issue of runaway litigation and fear of litigation here in this state, just as a brief reminder. Well, I want you to know that the Senate added the language that Representative Abler is specifically talking about, which is not exempting practitioners from their negligent care. And I understand both from the Cancer Society and from the MMA that is not sufficient. The Senate language doesn't do it. So we're sitting here agreeing to language and a concept of not exempting them from their negligent care, and that doesn't do it for the proponents of the bill, and that gives me some concern that we're going to end up with something outside of this committee that ventures away from what we might agree is a solution.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, forgive me for being late to this conversation. I was down in another committee, and so, but this bill is one that I've been having my eye on and I'm a little concerned about. Because I'm late on the conversation, some things may have happened, so please straighten me out if I'm wrong. But I guess what I wanted to know is, you know, is the provision now in the bill, or has there been some sort of change in the bill so that when somebody fails to do what they have a duty to do and somebody gets hurt, that there would be liability for the injured party? Is that now in the bill, or is that still out?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, President Ellison, in my opinion, that I don't think we're disagreeing with, that language is currently not in the bill. If they are negligent, although we may agree that what we missed is that we've talked about putting that in the bill, it's not currently there.
Representative Zayden.
And just to help this along, and I'd like to, I don't want to have to make you work by faith. I do have an oral amendment I'll offer if someone would offer it on my behalf. Just to give at least placeholder language to express the intent of this committee. I don't know if it's the final way it's going to go, but at least it will show the intent that I have. And I've run by a few people, and it's not perfect, but it's close. I'll offer it, Mr. Chair. On page 2? On page 2 of the amendment, I'll say it and somebody else can move it. After the word misconduct on page 1, line 2, page 2, line 1, after the misconduct, insert the words or malpractice unrelated to the quality of the cancer drug.
I'll move. Okay, Representative Ellison will move an oral amendment. Ms. McKnight, I just want to make sure that you and staff are tracking this, so if you could read that back to us and Representative Ellison can verify that that indeed is his oral amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, what I have is page 2, line 1, after misconduct, insert, or malpractice unrelated to the quality of the cancer drug, and I wonder if we should add or supply, because that's the term we're using all the time.
Sure.
Or is that?
That's helpful.
So then after misconduct, it would be insert, or malpractice unrelated to the quality of the cancer drug or supply.
Representative Ellison, is that track with your intent?
Yes, it does, Mr. Okay. Chair.
So we have before us the Ellison, oral amendment. Is there any discussion to the oral amendment? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, came in a little bit late on the discussion. I was out as well. Can you tell me just a short example of what this actually would help? Give me a scenario.
Okay, well,
Representative
Broad, the issue at hand, what we can't guarantee, we can give all the assurances you want, unless it comes from a wholesale drug company or a pharmacist who's been storing the stuff properly and they just have too much, they want to give it a good home. We can assure the quality of those based upon normal manufacturing standards. And the people who give those are liable for the quality. If you have Senator Solon, who's been tending her dying husband, who's the author of this bill in the Senate, that's where it came from, and then decides he's passed away and now she has all this stuff laying around and wants to bring it to the pharmacy and give it up. The pharmacist has no assurance how she watched. She's not a pharmacist, she's a wife, and so she was tending to him, and she kept it in the closet and where it should have been in the dark, and it was everything she knows to do, she did. And so, but the pharmacist can't guarantee that she was doing just right by that. The issue is about the quality. And so if the pharmacist dispenses the drug in good faith thinking it was a quality product and turns out not to be a quality product, that he's exempt from liability. Unless he didn't check the weight of the person and gave the wrong dosage. If he gave the wrong dosage, he's still liable. If he gave syringes that were broken, and he should have seen that. That's a bad example. But the first example where he has a duty to do his professional task and failed to do his professional task, unrelated just to the quality part that he couldn't control and couldn't know. This, I think, does that help?
Representative Rye?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chair. To a point, maybe Representative Ellison, maybe you can help me with just the legal standard of reckless then. Why aren't those things covered already in the amendment, just the descriptions that Representative Abler has brought forward?
Representative Ellison?
Mr. Chair, the answer to that question is that reckless, wanton, intentional misconduct, and then, on the other hand, negligence are all different standards in the law. Over the last few weeks, we've had conversations about jury instruction guidelines, and that's what's read to the jury. And when a judge reads an instruction on recklessness, the judge is going to tell the jury that this person is liable if they're reckless, if they have just, well, I don't know the exact language represented broad, but have disregarded a known risk or something like that. Wanton would be even worse. Intentional misconduct is they actually spike the medication in order to hurt somebody. But malpractice would be that there is a standard of care that all pharmacists agree that you should do, and they fail to do it, and as a result of that, someone was hurt. So, for example, the example I have in my mind, and I hope I'm not off base with this, but what I was thinking of is if you get some of these repository drugs from somebody who has leftover drugs, and somehow the packaging was opened, or somehow there was the condition of the packaging would leave a reasonable pharmacist in a position to say, hey, you know, something could be wrong with this medication. So, therefore, if there was a reason, if there was something they should have done, like recognize the package had been tampered with, and they couldn't, then, and somebody got hurt as a result, then they could have some liability. But if the packaging looks fine, and any other pharmacist would say, looks okay, this is with top repository drugs, they tell the person about it, then that's fine. Another example, if the chair would indulge me, could be if there's a requirement that the recipient of the medication be advised that this is repository medication. It came from somebody, not a pharmacy, not a manufacturer, but from somebody's home whose loved one passed on, and now here's the medication. It's cheaper because of that. If they fail to notify the person that that is exactly the situation, then there's a duty for them to notify as a professional standard, and that's what all the pharmacists agree should be the standard, then in that case, and if somebody, you know, then in that case, that they'd be responsible for their mistakes, just like everybody else is. So that, I hope, is a response to your question.
Is there any further discussion to the Ellison oral amendment? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The Ellison amendment is adopted. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, you stated earlier that there's 134 cases of medical malpractice filed in the last year in the state of Minnesota. Was that all cases of medical malpractice with dentistry, with pharmacies, with physicians, hospitals? Could you just go into exactly what that number is?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, members and Representative Dean, not only that, I can add to the list attorney malpractice, accountant malpractice, engineering malpractice, every single case that was filed as professional malpractice as according to the Minnesota Supreme Court State Court tracking system. It's everything.
Filed?
Everything filed in court, and I can tell you that number is exactly consistent with the National Practitioner Database and our Board of Medicine that has to report every professional malpractice settlement and payment made, whether it's by verdict or settlement, and last year reported in Minnesota, I believe there were about 90 of those.
Thank you. And just,
Representative Dean,
just to kind of go back, I understand that you are interested in looking at the folks who would be on the hook for this, for these medications down the road from the pharmacist to the hospital. You'd like to be able to sue those folks. The pharmacists, the hospitals, the physicians. One group that you did not mention in your argument was the donors, which in most cases is the widow or widower who would be providing these. It's on page 7, line 25. Would you have an objection to keeping that exemption in?
Mr. Carlson. Mr. Chairman and Representative Dean, first of all, just to be clear, We're not here to make sure that we can sue the hospital, the doctor, the pharmacist, or anybody else. What we're here for is to make certain that the consumer is getting quality medical care and not trying to protect what happens after the fact, but trying to prevent a bad event from happening in the first place. As to the donor and what their liability may or may not be, I don't think that the disclosure requirement is necessarily going to help or hinder them if there were if there were an accident related to the legislation. I don't think that that donor form is going to give them the type of protection that you may think that it would, because in many instances, in almost every instance that I've been able to hear during the testimony on this, the person who the drugs were prescribed for is deceased. And so you're asking for a disclosure from someone who's donating a drug that can't really give you a clear, in most instances, a clear indication of what the condition, care, and treatment of that unused portion of the drug has been. And so I don't know that that's protection for the donor who signs an affidavit saying this is all that great of protection to begin with.
Chair, I think that just goes to show that no good deed goes unpunished, and for a lot of these folks, they're really putting their last dollars down in line to keep their spouse alive with these expensive medications, and I can totally understand why it would help in part of the grieving process to at least make some good come out of that, and to say that this will keep these widows and widowers on the hook to get sued even though we put this provision in is rather troubling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I just want to ask you a quick question about your testimony, having come in a little bit later. I think I heard you to say something about the manufacturer essentially, my interpretation would be, given blanket immunity through this amendment. Can you clarify your actual comments versus my interpretation of them?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Broad, as I read the bill, they are a donor, as defined on the top of page 4. A drug manufacturer or wholesale drug distributor, they would be considered a donor, not as to the liability protection contained on the amendment in lines 4 through 13, but they would be a donor of the cancer drug as contained on line 17. And would pick up that liability protection as a donor. That is separate from the protection that they would obtain as a manufacturer. They are a donor. I don't know any other way to read
that. Ms. Broad?
No, that's fine, Mr. Chair. I was just looking for that clarification.
Further discussion to the bill? Any further discussion? Anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill? All right, seeing none, Representative, I will renew my motion that House File 127, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Health Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Members, we are maybe permanently adjourned, although there may be one bill we have to reschedule for. We're adjourned.